Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Would you like 2023 to be tax-free? Hey, it's Lars. Then make plans to join David Moore for a free webinar Wednesday, March 29th at 10 a.m. Pacific time for the latest 1031 exchange news and updates. For those asking for the nitty-gritty of a 1031 exchange, this is your class to learn the basics of the 1031 exchange, what qualifies, and how to apply the process. In this webinar, you'll learn the lingo, a glossary of terms, what you should know about doing an exchange in 2023, the benefits and pitfalls, and flipping with a 1031 exchange. If you're an Oregon broker, this 1031 exchange class provides attendees with 1 hour of core real estate continuing education and the knowledge to identify and apply the 1031 exchange to client investment real estate transactions. Plus, anybody who signs up gets a copy of the slides and a link to view the session again. For more information and registration, go to 1031exchange.com. You've worked hard to earn your money. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. I want you to imagine something. Imagine your elected representatives deciding to spend $12 million of your money on a project that has not been approved and a project that is not likely to be approved. Well, guess who's done that? We're going to tell you the details on it. And the man who follows this issue so closely, I've got to give him full credit for this, is John Lee, retired airline pilot, reporter, and of course, activist when it comes to the interstate bridge replacement and the phony baloney, almost $2 billion light rail project they have planned with it. John, welcome back to the program. We don't usually do interviews at the top of the noon hour, but I got to tell you something. This is really disturbing that the city of Vancouver would do this. Would you mind describing what they have done with so little discussion or even talking to the public about what they're doing? What have they done?
Hey, Lars, last night on the consent agenda, which means unless somebody raises questions, it gets blessed without any discussion whatsoever. The city moved forward and agreed to spend $12 million of the people's money on property that the county assessor was only worth $6.6 million, number one. Number two, they agreed to give an $8 million donation credit to the person selling it, indicating they believe the property is worth $12 million in total. All of this is allegedly for the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program. Why would the city buy the land instead of either the transit agency, CTRAN, or the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program? It makes absolutely no sense that the city would do this, let alone the huge question you asked, which was, this isn't even close to being approved yet by the federal government. Oregon hasn't funded their part of the deal. The transit administration at the federal level hasn't approved this yet. There are a million questions, and this just smokes of insider dealing on an unbelievable level here in Vancouver.
Okay, let's get to the details about the political connections and the special interests that are going to benefit. But let me say first, I want to see that bridge replaced, and it should be replaced with a simple bridge. It doesn't have to have light rail on it, doesn't have to look fancy or show up in Architectural Digest as a beautiful thing. It needs to be a functional bridge. However, that's not what they're proposing. And the price tag is about $7.5 billion if you assume, bad assumption, that the government will actually do something on budget. But there are a couple of major problems. Problem number one. The Federal Highway Transportation, I think it's the Federal Highway Administration, has said, yeah, at the height they're proposing to build this $7.5 billion bridge, it's too low for all ship traffic, so we want you to put a drawbridge in the middle of it. Am I correct?
You're correct, and that is the U.S. Coast Guard that must give approval in addition to the Federal Highway Administration. And a couple aspects of that issue. Number one, it's a repeat of exactly what happened during the old Columbia River crossing debate a decade ago, whether they came in with a bridge too low and the powers that be thought, oh, we'll just buy them off with the people's money. Well, over a year ago, the Coast Guard told the Interstate Bridge team, no, you are now proposing another bridge too low, and we want you to do something higher, preferably one that meets the current height requirements. A year passed, the IBR ignored it, did nothing, so the Coast Guard came in this last spring and said, we want a bridge with either 178 feet of clearance, which is the current bridge height when it's open, or a movable span. And if you don't do that, we're not going to give you the bridge permit in order to build the bridge.
And by the way, John, tell my audience, why is it so significant if they build a brand new bridge with a lift span or a movable span in the middle of it? Doesn't that just put us back where we are now with a bridge that occasionally stops working while the bridge span is open and traffic jams up on both sides?
Yep, it sure does. And of course, there are lots of other discussions on the side about how often and when they would do that. But absolutely, it becomes an issue, and they could potentially do a tunnel and totally avoid the bridge opening issues and not have any problems whatsoever with the airplanes out of Pearson Airport and all of those things. But they've ignored this because, just like in the old Columbia River crossing, this project ultimately is nothing more than a light rail project in search of a bridge.
And by the way, let's remind people, the current bridge has three lanes northbound on I-5. It has three lanes southbound on I-5. And even if there weren't a lift span, that's not adequate for current traffic. What are they proposing in total lanes north and south on the new bridge?
Three through lanes in each direction, plus one auxiliary lane, which is the lane where you merge onto the freeway or off the freeway. And they already admit that not only after they've spent $7.5 billion on this, but also after Oregon supposedly spends $1.5 billion at the Rose Quarter, that in 2045, morning travel times will double. What an outrageous waste of the people's money. Furthermore, they admit that the percentage of vehicles during rush hour stuck going 0 to 20 miles an hour will double to half of all the rush hour vehicles will be stuck going 0 to 20 miles an hour. What an unbelievable waste of the people's money.
I'm talking to reporter and activist. You're an activist as well, John Lee. John, the last piece of this. Who gets all this money that the city of Vancouver just agreed to spend $12 million in the cost for land that's only worth $6 or $6.5 million, and another $8 million in tax write-offs? Who's going to get to clean up on that one?
Well, after some digging this morning, I came across, it's a company called Evergreen Investors, and a little digging revealed that that was the Hornstein Law Group. They're very influential in downtown Vancouver politics in the business district. And what an unbelievable sweet deal. You buy the property for $4.8 million. You turn around and sell it not only for $12 million, but you also get a tax write-off for $8 million against future tax earnings and profits or whatnot. Unbelievable deal, and it just smacks of insider dealing on a horrible basis.
It sounds like just like the Ukrainians had in Joe Biden's office when he was vice president, it's good to have friends in public office. John, thank you very much for the update on this. I really appreciate it. That's John Lee, retired airline pilot, but he's made the Interstate Bridge a real interest of his. He's tracked it closely. Consider that. City of Vancouver agrees to spend $12 million on land appraised at $6 million and then hand out $8 million, $8 million in additional tax benefits. If anybody thinks that's a good deal to build a bridge that's no bigger than the old bridge, call me up and be a naysayer. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
You know, folks, I've got to say it. Crude corruption for literally sacks of cash cost Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan her job and any of her dreams that she might end up being governor of Oregon. But felonious Fagan did do us one small favor by exposing the kind of lies that those still in elective office tell to the public. Take Governor Tina Kotek, for example. When Willamette Week broke the news of Fagan's $10,000 a month in graft, Kotek acted like she didn't know. Quote, "I'm certainly very dismayed by the press reports. Today we find out from Oregon Live, Governor Kotek knew all about Fagan's sleazy side job because Fagan herself told the governor about it a week earlier and then lied about getting an ethics opinion that she never actually obtained. Kotek should have demanded that Fagan quit her corruption right then. She did not. I mean, corruption-funded Kotek's run for office last year. Remember the FTX money? $500,000 from the FTX cryptocurrency scam to the Democrat Party that funded Kotek's run? And then, of course, there's Congresswoman Val Hoyle and a bunch of other D party politicians. Apparently, the dismay about Fagan only hit Kotek when the story broke publicly. Privately, she apparently had no problem with it whatsoever. So Kotek lied to the public, and Fagan lied to voters when she ran for an office that she knew did not provide a paycheck big enough to pay her bills, which she has been whining about lately, saying, "Well, I couldn't pay my bills. I had to take $10,000 a month from LaModa, the weed store." Kotek must now explain why she kept citizens in the dark. Why did you lie to the public, Governor Kotek? Or she should follow sleazy Shamia right out the door. Now, about Joe Biden's commencement speech this weekend, one loyal Lars listener pointed out this in the Wall Street Journal. In keeping with the current tenor of political oratory, it was a low, dispiriting affair, one that aptly captured the low, dispiriting nature of Joe Biden's presidency. Acerbic rhetoric from a partisan who demonizes opposition and divides Americans from one another. Bottomless self-unawareness from a politician elected president almost accidentally in a moment of crisis, who continues to see himself as some sort of historical savior. Cynical cant from a serial fabulist whose distortions are becoming as loathsome as the endless malign fictions of the predecessor he despises and who he desperately needs as a foil. And on Twitter, get this, except in the case of convicted felons and underage people, since when does the government have the right to say who can and cannot run for political office? This is from Pat in Beaverton. Pat's talking about Measure 113. Measure 113, unfortunately passed by the voters, says that if Oregon representatives walk out of the legislature for 10 days in a row, they may not run for re-election. The law to bar representatives from re-election for missing meetings is not constitutional. Electors decide who they want to represent them, not the government. Let's get that law overturned. Keep up the good work, signed Pat. And I said, Pat, the voters approved it, but I'm completely in favor of overturning that law. And our question of the day, Rick writes in, Lars, I think that new law that says they can't run for the next term in office, assuming they don't win a lawsuit. However, could they have their spouse run with the publicized note that the senator or rep will be a chief of staff for the spouse and then run again the following term? Your thoughts? Rick, I think it's a good workaround. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Better Basements and Waterproofing. Water in your crawl space or basement? Call Better Basements and Waterproofing.
I've told you for years that I don't like vote by mail. I don't trust vote by mail. I think there are too many opportunities for fraud, and I think fraud has been employed in elections, not just around the country, but here in Oregon and in Washington. So consider this. The Democrats force vote by mail for elections of the country's leaders. And there's ample opportunity for Democrat Party cheating. They use the pandemic as an excuse. But guess what? Yesterday, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, signed a law that eliminates vote by mail elections. Wait for it. not for the general public, not for elective office statewide in California, but for union certification by farm workers. And why does Gavin Newsom say you can't do it? He vetoed a bill last year to allow vote by mail in union elections because Gavin Newsom said he, quote, could not support an untested mail election process that lacks critical provisions to protect the integrity of the election. And one of those provisions, card check. That's where union organizers come into a workplace and they'll ask a worker, they'll say, would you like to have a vote on whether or not to be unionized? And sometimes workers will say, I wouldn't mind putting it to a vote, but I'm not in favor of it. So they sign the card, that so-called card check. Guess what happens when they get to 51% of the workers who've signed card check? A union is formed and you are forced to be in it. And many of those workers then say, when did that happen? I never voted on it. They said, oh, we'll have an election on it. But for right now, the union is formed and they don't get a vote. The second issue is this. If you have card check, then every union organizer knows who signed and who did not. Now, what do you suppose, how welcome do you suppose workers are at a workplace when they didn't sign off to support the union? Not very popular at all. But if you had vote by mail in a union election, well, then you could vote in private. And the union wouldn't know whether you said yes or no to it. It would give you the freedom to make your own decision. Gavin Newsom doesn't want that because that's not what the unions want. Our best email today, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Robbie Igo writes in, Lars, the John Durham report only proves what many of us have suspected for a long time. The DOJ lies, and the FBI lies too, by the way, Robbie. Furthermore, it shows again the federal bureaucracy can't be trusted and that America is on the road to a banana republic. I don't agree with it, but it's no wonder what other countries are increasingly looking to China to solve the world's problems. They lie, but they admit it. America lies through its teeth. As a citizen, I don't trust our government anymore. Every agency lies, doesn't have the American people first, and it's all a grab for money. The state level, just as bad. In general, if any government agency or politician claims anything, typically the opposite is going to be true. Signed, Robbie. Welcome to Tuesday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. My Twitter poll today, now that we know that Governor Kotek lied to the public about what she knew of the corruption of former Secretary of State Fagan, should Kotek resign? I would say yes to that. And if she doesn't want to resign, she should explain to the public why she found it so dismaying when the corruption of Shamia Fagan became public, but she wasn't outraged at all when Shamia Fagan told her to her face that she was taking outside money from an agency regulated by the state. Shamia Fagan was forced to resign, and she should have. And now Tina Kotek should have this choice. Either explain your lies to the public or just sign off and get out of office altogether. Today's Twitter poll brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you're wondering, because it is a common sense question, why in the world would a man so old and so feeble and so demented as Joe Biden run for re-election? And the fact is, it's easy to make the case that Joe Biden is running for re-election because he has no choice. And the thing that gives him no choice is a woman by the name of Kamala Harris, who is currently vice president, and if anything, is less popular even than the very unpopular Joe Biden. I thought I'd talk about that with one of my favorite Democrats, lifelong friend Josh Markey, who joins us now. Josh usually comes on to talk about legal issues. But Josh, welcome back to the program. Does Joe Biden have any choice but to run for re-election, given that his clear successor could end up being Kamala Harris?
Well, I'll probably vote for Joe Biden again if he runs, and I think a lot of people will, but in part because I think Kamala Harris, who I knew not terribly well, but I did know her before she became a senator. She was a district attorney, and after that, she was the Attorney General of California. She is a very ambitious woman, and there's nothing wrong with ambition in politics, but she makes people very, very uncomfortable, and particularly those who get to know her, which is worse.
Is she just ambitious? Because I have no problem with ambition either. I consider myself an ambitious person. But is she capable?
I don't know. I mean, you know, she served as the district attorney. That's the one thing she probably did well, because all the other DAs in San Francisco before her were so horrible. And then what she did is she started a pattern that she did through, has done throughout her career, of securing power, getting halfway through the next term. And then when she's running what in politics we call from a position of safety, meaning that whether she wins the next election or not, she still has a good job. She did that as district attorney. She won a paper thin election to Attorney General of California against the Los Angeles County DA. And then from there, won a paper thin election to the United States Senate.
Where and she then, only course, served for 4 years and didn't accomplish much of anything, correct?
No, not really. In fact, I was stunned. I, as you have often, you know, both taunted and said accurately, I'm a Democrat, and I watched the Democratic convention, and I was kind of horrified by the debates, because I thought that Harris went way out of her lane to essentially accuse, you know, Uncle Joe of being a racist. And if somebody had done that to me, I certainly wouldn't reward them by giving the number two seat on the ticket. And I'm not sure what she brought with it.
You know what I think she brought? And I want you to be honest. You're a Democrat. I'm a conservative and a Republican second. I consider myself a conservative first. She brought two things. She is female and she is black. She was hired for that reason by Joe Biden to be his running mate. Am I right?
Yes, you're right.
And she and at this point, when you say you don't know if she's capable or not, let's see. She's the border czar and has only gone near the border one single time. And that wasn't even at the border. There's a crisis at the border right now. By President Obama's definition, there's a crisis times 10 at the border right now, because he said, or his Homeland Security Secretary guy, Jay Johnson, said anything north of 1,000 a day is a crisis. We're now at well over 10,000 per day. And that is a crisis times 10. And what has, can you name a single thing that Kamala Harris has done about the border?
Well, I'm assuming, and I don't give her any great credit for it, I think it's almost funny, except it's sad, that she apparently got federal military troops to go to the border at the same time that Republican Governor Greg Abbott got Texas National Guard troops to go to the border. I frankly don't see what the difference is. And I'm not entirely sure why they're using National Guard. I mean, clearly our border policy overall has failed, and it's been failing for a long time. A lot of liberals, and I don't consider myself one of them, want to believe that America is literally an open door for anyone under any circumstances. And people who say that have clearly not traveled the world, because there is no country, not Scandinavia, not Great Britain, certainly not Canada, that just says, throw the doors open and bring me your huddle, your poor, your criminals, you know, the people you don't want. I don't like the guy you support for president, Donald Trump, and I don't like a lot of the things he said, but he does have a tendency to say some things out loud that are sometimes true. And Mexico has deliberately it's what Fidel Castro did in 1981, so-called Marielitos. He basically dumped his worst on us.
Let me try two data points. Did Donald Trump reduce illegal crossings of the border to one of the lowest levels in American history?
I don't know if he did. I'll take your word.
I believe he did based on the numbers. Has Joe Biden taken the illegal crossings to a stratospheric level, 9 million at this point, not even 2.5 years in, 9 million people have illegally crossed in the last 2 years, and Joe and his Homeland Security guy, Mayorkas, all run around saying, there's no crisis at the border. We have the border under control. So when you have a president who brought it low and a president who's taken it high, I know you don't like Trump. The fact is, he did a good job.
Well, you know, I said this about Democrats, and, you know, even the blind pig finds the truffle occasionally. The fact of the matter is, American border policy is incredibly complex. A simple answer, which is no one will cross or welcome everybody, both of them are going to fail miserably. And we live in an increasingly international world, and we've got the Mexican government, a leftist populist, who is deliberately pushing people from places like Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala through Mexico and deliberately into our laps, making it our problem.
Yeah, because guess what's going to happen? They're going to work here. They're going to end up with jobs, and they're going to send tens of billions of dollars back to Mexico. It's Mexico's second largest source of income is remittances, people right. illegally in America, working at jobs illegally, and then sending money back to Mexico and now other third world countries. So I guess let's get back to the question of where this election's going to go, because Joe Biden says he's going to run for re-election. I think the biggest reason he's running isn't necessarily Kamala Harris. I think it's because he understands that if they actually finish an investigation into his son, and they've got big chunks of it done already, and they already have the bank records to show that many of Hunter Biden's illicit deals had monies that flowed right back to Joe Biden, the minute he steps out of the White House, he is very indictable. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know if he's indictable. I'm sure he's he should be worried about Hunter Biden. I actually knew his other son, the one that died of cancer. He was a prosecutor and he was the attorney general. And like many families, you know, you have, you know, the son that achieves and makes the father proud, and then you got the other one.
And
the fact of the matter is that Biden would probably do anything. I don't think staying in office is going to immunize Hunter Biden from prosecution. I really don't believe the system protects that much. It does a little bit. You know, Donald Trump saw that, but not entirely. I think he's running because the Democratic Party really doesn't have another choice. There's just nobody else that's even remotely ready for prime time yet.
You still call yourself a Democrat, Josh. What does that say about a party when they say we've got an empty bench when it comes to the number one job? You got the last 20 seconds.
Well, I don't know. The Democratic Party largely left me. You know, there are issues about which I still stand with them. But, you know, I'm not one of those people who say, oh, my party, right or wrong. I vote for what I think. And I think a lot of Oregonians, people in the United States do. I'm very concerned about how our country is becoming so incredibly and angrily divided. I think that is bad for everybody.
I think so, too. Hang on for just a second, Josh. Glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. When we come back on the Radio Northwest Network, I'm going to talk to Josh about some issues in the Pacific Northwest, because I want to know from him whether or not he thinks the current governor, having lied about significant corruption within Oregon government, is going to it actually merits her resignation from office. We'll get to that in just a moment. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 23 and a half years, and glad to stay with you. It's a beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest, and we're glad to be with you and glad to take your calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Calling all men and the people who love them. We have a message for you because, hey, it's your life, but also it's your life. Here's what you need to know. 1 in 8 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer in his lifetime. For black men, that stat is 1 in 6. When prostate cancer is caught early, it's highly treatable. But because most men have no symptoms, it's vital to talk with your doctor at your annual visit about prostate cancer screening. For 30 years, the Prostate Cancer Foundation has funded cutting-edge research that has helped patients live longer with fewer complications. Today, PCF continues to take the lead in both breakthroughs and as a trusted resource and community. So when it comes to prostate cancer, go to PCF.
Morning, consumers. This can happen to you.
You know, if I can digress for just a second, last night I was on the television. I was on the telephone.
This is what can happen when you order a president by mail. Next time, pick your president in person. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Mumbles all the time. What did he say?
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And Josh Marquis, former DA, but today he's talking more like the politician that he is. Josh, welcome back. I wanted to talk to you about a couple of issues involving Oregon's governor. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek appears to have actually lied. Dusty, let's put that on pause, please, if you don't mind. But Kotek appears to have lied to the public. She made it appear by saying, I was dismayed to see these press reports about Shamia Fagan, now former and disgraced former Secretary of State, that she was taking money from a company regulated by a state agency that Fagan, as Secretary of State, was in the middle of auditing. And Kotek made it appear that she only knew about this from the press reports, when in fact we now learn, because of the reporting of OregonLive.com, that Fagan had told her about this contract she had with LaModa, the weed retailer, a week before. If she's lying to the public and now saying she's dismayed, but apparently when Fagan told it to her face, she didn't say, well, you can't be engaged in that kind of behavior. You need to quit that right now. She did no such thing, and instead made the public think, oh, Governor Kotek learned about this with the rest of us. Should she have to resign over that?
Well, I think she should, but I think it goes larger than that. And although I have been a Democrat virtually all my life, I was a big supporter of Betsy Johnson, the independent candidate for governor. And I was concerned, and still am, about Tina Kotek as our governor. It was a very, very sort of, it's a very weak bench, the Democrat. But I think this is bigger than just another mistake by another Democratic politician. We are talking about rot that is now going through everything. And I have someone, and you and I have had these conversations over the years, where I said, well, Oregon's not like Illinois. It's not like New Jersey. It's not like Louisiana. I don't know if we can say that anymore. I mean, what we are now seeing with, at worst, of course, the Secretary of State, which is, as ironically, Shamia Fagan wanted everybody in America to think she was the lieutenant governor. She actually, at one point, demanded a driver and security officer from the Oregon State Police on the, because she heard that other lieutenant governors got them and had to be put in her place by OSP officials who said, we don't do that. That's the kind of arrogance that Shamia Fagan showed. But the question is this just a one-off? And the answer is no, it's not. We have an attorney general, Alan Rosenblum, who is the most political AG in, 40, 50 years. There have been a lot of Democratic attorney generals, John Kroger, Hardy Myers, Ted Kulongowski, and there have been Republican attorney generals like Dave Frommeyer, but none of them have ever brought the party before Oregon in the way that Ellen Rosenblum does. And so we're talking about the entire Democratic bench is involved in a system of rewards and deceptions that goes really deep and is criminal. And most people don't realize that technically in Oregon, election law investigations are supposed to be done by the Secretary of State, and they're supposed to be prosecuted by the Attorney General. District attorneys, of whom there are 36 elected ones in Oregon, and I was one for 25 years, are specifically written out of the enforcement system for a variety of reasons. By the same token, the Attorney General is written out of for other crimes. But if the fact is that you have a corrupt executive, meaning the governor, Secretary of State, Attorney General, and then talking about the leadership of the legislature, and they are unwilling to enforce the law, and they're willing to stand by, well, to me, Lars, the real kicker was when I discovered, by reading Willamette Week primarily, that these bribes, because they really are more bribes than they were contributions, were paid in cash. They were bags of money of $5,000,
$5,000, large amounts of money. And that's just, it's crazy, because as even a liberal lawyer like Mr. Kafoury pointed out, and he's a liberal activist, but he's a lawyer, he said, look, when it's cash, you don't know how much of it goes into the campaign and how much goes into the candidate's pocket, right?
Well, yeah, for example, and if I think there was, and this money came from a company that has now been disclosed to owe millions of dollars to the people in the form of federal and state taxes in terms of the industry, in terms of all the downstream marijuana producers who actually make the marijuana, grow it, distill it, et cetera. So I guess it appears that the owners of LaMotta, this very young couple, have been greasing the wheels by making the decision to give hundreds of thousands of dollars to make them their personal friends. And that's been a real theme here. Oh, no, these are my personal friends.
Absolutely right. That's Josh Marquis, the former DA, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. And much of the legislature is hanging fire right now because Republicans in the legislature have decided to deny quorum. Now, I know most of the media is pinning this as Republicans have a job to do, and Republicans should just shut their yaps and go to Salem and sit there and don't have any part in the actual decision-making, but sit there and provide a quorum so the Democrats can vote through anything they want, including House Bill 2002, which, believe it or not, provides for abortions for 10-year-old girls. It provides for transsexual support, a gender-affirming care, they want to call it, without the knowledge or permission of parents. And worse than that, it repeals a law that says that if you bear a baby, dead or alive, and then you conceal the corpse of that baby, that's a crime. This would eliminate that as well. And that is just outrageous in and of itself. So it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Republican Representative Emily McIntyre, who represents Oregon's 56th district. That's Klamath Falls. I used to live in Klamath Falls a long time ago. Representative McIntyre, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
So how long are the Republicans going to stay out? Because I think it's part of their job to sit out when the Democrats say, we're going to pass stuff whether you like it or not. I think my personal opinion, just so you know it, is that your job is to stay out of there so they can't do that. You give me your take on the whole situation, if you don't mind, ma'am.
Sure. So I couldn't give you an answer for how long the Senate Republicans plan on staying out. I know that it's not a decision that they take lightly. I would also tell you that several of them are coming and still going to committee and still trying to work through some of the policies. This really isn't something that they have done on a whim, and so I really support what they're doing. As far as walking out, I totally hear what you're saying. I understand it. I probably am leading you down a different rabbit trail, but that ballot measure 113 didn't do us any favors. I can tell you, too, that on the House side, our job for 2002, because the House was communicating with the Senate when 2002 was coming to the floor. And first of all, a few weeks prior to us hearing 2002, we were asked by the Senate to slow down the House. And so the House stepped up to the plate, and we slowed down the House about 3 weeks before we actually heard 2002 on the floor. And we did 7 to 8 hours on the floor passing only a handful of bills. And we made our Democratic colleagues so annoyed that they were willing to compromise with us on putting a date to 2002. So that was our job. We accomplished the job. We heard 2002 on the floor. We did about 10 hours of testimony on that bill, bringing up all of the different points that we wanted to have there for potential litigation, for pointing out holes, to make sure that the citizens could go back and have access to really, truly understand, to know that my Democrat colleagues knew exactly what was in this bill. And we made sure that they knew it by the end of the day that we voted on that bill. So our job on this one was to not walk out. Our job on this one was to make sure that every single person in the state and country knew every single detail, horrible detail, that was in 2002. And we accomplished that.
All right. So, but what should you do at this point? Because if the Senate's gone and the Senate's walked out and they don't come back, and some of them have already hit that measure 113 limit that says you can't run for reelection. I agree with you. I don't think it's constitutional. It was passed by the voters. So there you go. But, but at this point, I think it's the job of the Republicans to sit out. And if the Republicans are out, nothing the House does is going to get passed, which means it can't get signed by Governor Kotek, right?
You are right. Yep.
So that means there's really no point in the House being there either, is there?
Well, I would actually push back on that a little bit. And my reason being is that there's a job that we're here to do. So if we deny quorum and we are absent those 10 days, and so Lars, like, this is my first time, right?
I can tell you
that, like, in the 5 short months that I have been doing this, this has been one of the most stressful and traumatic things that I've ever done. Not to sound like a whiner, right? Like, just to say, like, you don't understand this House until you're in it. And I am just a normal, everyday person. I'm on a school board. I'm a mom. I don't have a college education. I simply am here by blood,
neither do I, ma'am.
Right. Blood, sweat, and tears. And truly, most importantly, by the absolute grace of God, do I even sit in this seat at all. And I feel that the other side of that is, if we deny quorum and we walk out and we all are unable to run again in 2 years, right?
Or really in a year and a half. Then the Democrats get what they want, right?
They get what they want, and you have a brand new Republican legislature for the for this side, right? So
yep.
I can tell you the learning curve on this has been so insanely sharp. Like, I have no idea what I'm doing half the time. I say that tongue in cheek. I work really hard to know every single detail of what I need to know. But to come into this and not having the support of senior Republican legislatures, there's been several representatives that have helped me, come alongside me, mentored me, given me direction, given me areas to go, all the while that they're trying to negotiate what they're doing. If we put in brand new Republicans into this House, you're going to have a nightmare on your hand, because they're just going to get rolled time and time again.
That was exactly the term I thought of, Representative McIntyre. You're going to get rolled. And that's probably what the Democrats want. Push you far enough, get you to walk out, don't run. I understand why you stay then, because effectively the Democrats are shut down by the absence of the Senate. Can I ask you about something else that does relate to state government? Okay, did you see the reports that Governor Kotek knew about the corruption of Shamia Fagan, said nothing to her when Fagan told it to her face, but then acted dismayed? Oh, I'm dismayed to see the reports. It seems to me Governor Kotek has lied to the public about what she knew about the corruption, only expressed dismay once it went public. I think Governor Kotek needs to answer or resign. What do you think?
Well, are you surprised?
I'm not surprised, but I want to know, do you think, as a state representative from Klamath Falls, that Governor Kotek should either explain why she apparently lied to the public by saying, or resign?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Either or both, right? Like, I'm here to get rid of corruption, right? I'm here to be honest. I'm not here to try to hide something or push an agenda that has malicious intent. And I'm not going to say that I'm accusing anyone of doing that, but I also think when there is blatant corruption that's been done by people that have had protection of an office, we absolutely should be looking to hold them accountable by the Constitution and by the letter of the law.
Very good. Representative Ellie McIntyre from the Klamath Falls Basin. Back in just a moment. We'll talk about the broken window theory in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to ask you something. Have you ever heard of the broken window theory? I'm going to apply it, even though it was created about 40 years ago by a social scientist named James Q. Wilson. And you'll recognize it fairly quickly, but let me get to that in a moment. And how it's not being applied today. In fact, major media is objecting to the idea that you actually use law enforcement and enforce the rules in places like public housing to try to make public housing a decent place to live, which if you ever ask somebody, what do you think of public housing? Most people get an image of their mind, and it's an accurate one for most cities in America, that public housing is usually a sewer. There are good people living there, but they are forced to put up with way too much from their fellow tenants, who are a smaller number of people, but in many cases obnoxious, and in more cases they are criminals. But let me get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You can dial in at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, that is, you disagree with my point of view, I'm glad to take your call. And as we always have, for about a quarter of a century, we've always said that naysayers go to the head of the line. Because if my arguments or my point of view or my position on any given issue does not stand up to tough scrutiny and tough questions, well, then I don't deserve to hold that point of view. But let's get back to the broken windows theory. I first learned about the broken windows theory in the 1980s. And it's fairly simple, although it doesn't necessarily make common sense immediately. If you told somebody that your community had massive problems with violent crime, things like murder and rape and robbery and armed assault, you'd say, well, you've got to go out and arrest those really, really bad guys, which is true. But it's also true that if you focus on the little stuff and you solve the little stuff, the kinds of crimes that most people think of as chippy little crimes that don't matter, things like shoplifting, things like in New York City, where it famously happened, these so-called window washers who would go out with a squeeze bottle or a squirt bottle and a squeegee. Sometimes they're called squeegee men. And they would stand at a street corner, and when your car pulled up to a halt, I never lived in Manhattan, but I've visited plenty of times, and I've seen them at work. They'd come up and wash somebody's window on their car while they're sitting there. And then they would usually expect, sometimes they were not happy when they didn't get it, a tip. A dollar or two. And those are the squeegee men. It was basically a little bit of extortion. I washed your window, now give me a tip. Now, when you have that kind of thing, when you have petty theft and things like that, James Q. Wilson, this social scientist who actually started out, he died about a decade ago, but he started out as kind of a liberal. And the more he got into taking a look at social science and economics and everything else, the more conservative he became. And here's what his theory was, called the broken window theory, and then I'll get to the current use or lack of use of that right now. He said, if you have a neighborhood, and let's say the neighborhood is either industrial or residential, so it could be factories, it could be people's houses. If a number of the houses become, say, abandoned, and you allow some broken windows, you're going to get more of them. Because people drive through the neighborhood, or they live in the neighborhood, or they walk through the neighborhood, and they notice there are a bunch of broken windows. Hey, I think I'll pick up a rock and break a window. Now, that's not everyone. But pretty soon, the whole neighborhood is full of broken windows. And then other crimes start to happen. And his theory was that if every time you had one of these problems, that you actually got after the problem very quickly, you do the little stuff, and all of a sudden, the big stuff takes care of itself. You know what? It actually worked. In fact, the then mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, began to employ this in places, big tourist places, but big commercial places in New York City like Times Square. And what he said was, We're going to go after crimes, not just the big stuff. We'll go after that, too. But we're going to go after the little stuff, the pickpockets. We'll go after the shoplifters and the petty theft and the petty little, well, like the squeegee men, the semi-extortionist crimes. And if we solve that, what happens is the other criminals who might commit the more serious crimes, they're going to go away. And you say, Lars, that's crazy. Guess what? That theory from 40 years ago actually worked in the 1990s. Rudy Giuliani largely cleaned up crime in New York City. Well, guess what's happening now? The Washington Post ran a story, and they ran it today. And they're outraged that what's happened in public housing, you know, this is housing that is, for the most part, given almost free of charge or at very low cost to the people who live in it. In many cases, it's Section 8 housing. But when it's built by public agencies and the people who live in it have no real reason to take good care of it, they don't own it, they're not renting it, they don't really have a landlord that pays attention because usually it's the state or federal government, that all of a sudden crime begins to happen. Little stuff first, big stuff later on. So what is the Washington Post outraged about? Well, it turns out that some grants were given, federal grants or local grants, to put up a closed circuit TV cameras. And in some cases, they put up a lot of these cameras. And they were monitored to some extent by the people who manage public housing. And they began to enforce the rules. In other words, when somebody decided to loan their key fob to enter the building to somebody who didn't actually live there, that's a violation of the rules. And why is that a problem? Because if somebody's inclined to go out and commit burglary or maybe assault, they don't want to do it in their own building because they'll be identified. So they find a way to get in. Now, what the Washington Post complains about today, they said these cameras and the images from them are being used to punish and evict public housing residents, sometimes for what the Washington Post says are minor rule violations. Although the minor rule violation, like letting somebody into a secure apartment, into the common areas, the hallways, when they don't actually live there, is inviting them to engage in other kinds of crime, whether it's theft, whether it's robbery, whether it's burglary, whether it's drug dealing, whatever it happens to be. And enforcing those rule violations actually makes people pay attention to it. And here's the way they sum it up. In public housing facilities around America, local officials are installing a new generation of powerful and pervasive surveillance systems, imposing an outside level of scrutiny on some of the nation's poorest citizens. Well, here's the dirty little secret. An awful lot of criminal activity is done by people who live in or near the people they victimize. And the people they victimize are often like them. They're poor as well. Now, if you're a poor person and somebody burglarizes your apartment, steals your stuff, or wrecks your stuff, that hurts you pretty badly. In many cases, you won't have insurance. You certainly don't have the bank account to make up what got stolen from you. So it hurts especially bad for those people. And yet, the Washington Post sympathy is, how dare you actually enforce the rules in these places and maybe make sure that the criminals stay away? They say housing agencies have been buying these tools, some equipped with facial recognition, and that has a whole different set of concerns, with no guidance or limits on their use. The risks are poorly understood, and little evidence exists that they make the community safer. Fact is, this actually works for the law-abiding citizen who's forced to live in public housing because they don't have the means to go anywhere else. Enforcing the rules actually makes the place safer for them. And that's a good thing, but the Washington Post doesn't like it. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. You know, artificial intelligence is something that holds great promise in many ways. But like most tools, whether it's a gun or a knife or, let's say, my favorite, a chainsaw, it is both great and useful. It can also be very, very dangerous if it is not handled properly. And Will Reinhart knows that. He's senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Will, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell me this, is artificial intelligence as deadly and potentially dangerous, as some experts are claiming it? And does humanity need to be protected from its own invention?
I think there are potential downsides. I think there are real costs to some of these new technologies. But, you know, at the same time, I think there's a lot of benefit. And so where we're at right now, and especially what's going on today with the in the Senate, is I think everyone's trying to suss out what that's going to look like. They're trying to figure out where the costs are going to exist, but they're also trying to figure out where the benefits are going to exist.
So how do they do that? And I'll tell you, one of my fears, Will, is that I see the benefit to AI. You know, I understand. And my favorite example, I think it was a published piece a couple of weeks ago where they said using AI, I've known a couple of people over the years who've been radiologists, and they take a look at somebody's CAT scan or their MRI or the radiograph, you know, x-rays that have been taken of one kind or another. And they say, we're looking for signs that you may have cancer coming. The piece I saw said, with AI, the computer could spot changes that are so minute and so subtle that a human being, even a very good radiologist, is not going to spot them, but the computer could spot the patterns. And as we add more data, could spot the patterns so well, we might catch cancer, for example, a lot easier. That sounds fantastic. How do we end up controlling this technology so it's not used in a way that's bad for human beings, but we do get those uses at the same time, and we don't curb innovation?
I mean, I think that, you know, for better or worse, there's already a lot of government regulation that already exists. And the things that ultimately are going to happen is that AI, as you said, is going to be integrated into various services, right? It's going to go into medical services, and it's going to go into, you know, a lot of healthcare. It's going to go into content creation. And each one of those areas is highly regulated. And so the way I see it is that, yeah, there's a lot of potential downsides to these new technologies. And it's really a suite of technologies, right? It's a whole bunch of different technologies happening all at the same time. But I think that at the same time, there's also this intense regulatory system that exists, as you well know, that ensures that, you know, if there truly are problems, things are going to be dealt with in courts. They're going to be dealt with by regulatory agencies like the FTC or the DOJ, you know, the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice. So, you know, there's a lot of downsides, but I think that personally, I think there's going to be a lot of action already happening anyway that's going to try to regulate these new technologies.
Well, I hope you're right about that. But for instance, Will, if you went back to sort of the advent of cell phones, I remember the first ones coming to the town where I lived in 1985. I never could have afforded the technology. I only got into it about 5 years later. And if you had said to people, hey, if you have these cell phones, they're going to be endlessly useful for lots of things. But they're also going to allow perverts to prey on your children without you even knowing about it. And you would have said, that's crazy. How could that happen? It's a phone. It's a wireless phone, but it's a phone. And yet today we know that there are perverts out there who try to prey on young kids because of messaging apps, because of the internet, because of other things, much of it tracing back to cell phones. He said, I never would have expected that this device could bring all these evils into my family. And that's the part I'm worried about. With AI, the scariest initial thing that we can imagine, there are probably a lot we can't, is the idea that I could take a sample of your voice from this interview. I could make it sound just like you. I could then cause it to call, say, your home and convince your wife, you know, of something. Hey, Will just told you, hey, honey, it's Will. I need you to transfer $10,000 to Lars's bank account. And I'm reasonably sure that there will be crooks out there who will do that. So how do we get a handle on that, again, without curbing the innovation?
Yeah, I that's what we're going to have to work through case by case. You know, as you said, there the DOJ does a lot of this work against, CSAM, which is all the child exploitation material. So there are cases that are brought by the federal government, by policing agencies, right, by the FBI. They're getting in on those sorts of cases. They use advanced technologies, and I think that in the future they're going to have to continue using those technologies to do the investigative work to figure out where these people and these individuals are unfortunately, you know, spreading content. So that I think is a positive use of these new technologies. But, you know, the broader thing that I see happening is that the government in all of its different facets is going to be regulating this new technology in a whole bunch of different ways. It's going to happen in consumer protection. It's going to happen in, you know, the Department of Justice with CSAM. It's going to happen with you know, with automobiles and autonomous vehicles, all the things that we see, all of the innovation that we see that's happening is happening in different industries. And so it's going to get regulated, each one of those industries, slightly differently because it's an input to all of these new technologies and this new innovation. It's not the output. It's not the thing that we're looking for.
Yeah, I guess the thing I'm concerned about is this. Could we agree that government is pretty stupid about technology most of the time? They're kind of, and especially Congress, they're just clueless half the time. They'll say, I don't even know how my cell phone works. And yet even the high tech companies that deal with this all the time, like Twitter and Facebook and all, we say to them, why can't you keep the kiddie porn off your, you know, off of these platforms? And they say, well, we try as hard as we can. We can't. I mean, somehow, before Musk bought Twitter, they were capable of silencing just about any conservative voice that you could name. But they said, but we're not capable of silencing, you know, the exchange of child pornography and really evil stuff like that. Even the people in the business say, we don't know how to get it done. And so I have even less confidence that the regulators who work outside of the private industry and maybe aren't as current with things, that they're going to be able to write the rules to make it happen.
Yeah, and there's a slightly smaller concern I also have with this conversation, which is that, you know, as I was watching the hearing today in the Senate, one of the big things that many of the panelists were talking about, which is, you know, slightly, I think, really, really interesting. So what is, you know, as you said, the government is bad in a lot of this. And I think the real big question that I'm trying to understand is, how is Congress potentially going to mess this up or make things better? And the big thing that was going on, at least in this hearing today, is a conversation over regulation. What should regulation look like, right? A lot of these things that you're mentioning, you know, have been brought up or brought up during the hearing today. And to me, what I think is the key, the most important part of all of this is that we don't overregulate this at the same time, right? We're kind of dancing around the fact that there are very serious problems that could come about if we take too strong of a hammer to all these AI technologies. While there are problems, you know, we need to ensure that all of the people in Silicon Valley are disrupted. We need to make sure that the Googles and the Microsoft, you know, are undercut by new entrants into the market that can kind of shift around the market and make things more competitive. So while at the same time, we need to ensure that people are protected, I think the real big thing is to ensure that we don't overregulate in this and that we're not, you know, taking a step too far in the way that we actually regulate AI technologies going forward.
I'm talking to Will Reinhardt from the Center for Growth and Opportunity. See, I've got the same concern. I think the government could screw up an ice cream sundae without even trying. And I do worry that they'll say, well, if that's the potentially bad stuff, we'll just make rules saying nobody can do that. It'll do two things. One, you'll cut down on innovation. Two, you'll probably cut down on competition because the big companies will be able to handle it because they can handle regulation very well. They've got the infrastructure. The little guys, which is where you often find the innovation, they won't be able to handle it. And if there's a marketplace for the evil use of the technology, you can just about guarantee that the dark web is going to somehow supply it. Will, thanks for the time. That's Will Reinhardt from the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Back in a moment. We'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Joe, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And, of course, you can vote in our Twitter poll. We put up a brand-new question each and every day. This one is a bit bold. Now, let me suggest that to you. But first, I'll tell you that this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Now, here's the question I want to ask you. And I'll make the case that I think that Governor Tina Kotek, who has only been in office for a few months, although Oregon has been in this spot before, John Kitzhaber was barely in office on his historic fourth term when he was forced to resign in disgrace because of the corruption of his girlfriend, who John Kitzhaber allowed to do pay for play out of his office, literally operating her private company out of his office. Now, he was forced to resign. So Oregon's already seen this situation. It gave us the accidental governor of Kate Brown. Well, now we've got Shamia Fagan, Secretary of State, has resigned in disgrace over corruption. She was taking $10,000 a month in cash from people involved in one of the biggest retail marijuana stores in the Pacific Northwest, and one that was allowed to continue operating even though they were literally millions of dollars behind in federal and state taxes, and they were hundreds of thousands of dollars behind in the fees they were supposed to pay for their weed operation. Now, you now have Tina Kotek. And Tina Kotek, it seems, lied to the public. And let me tell you, I'll cite my source on this. I don't often give them credit. Usually I call them the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. But Therese Bottomley's OregonLive.com did a good job. This morning, they broke a story that says that when Tina Kotek, after she saw the press reports from Willamette Week and reporter Sophie Peel that Shamia Fagan had been involved in a consulting contract for $10,000 in cash. I don't mean in a check. I mean in cash money. Now, when you're paying people huge amounts of money in cash, it's oftentimes an illicit business. If you're buying a car, usually don't buy it with stacks of Benjamins. If you're buying a house, you don't buy it with bags of cash. You do it with cashier's checks and wire transfers and the like. And yet, it seems a whole bunch of Democrats took that money. Shamia Fagan took it. But the significant thing that Oregon Live came out with today was they said Governor Kotek knew about that consulting arrangement. She may not have known the exact dollar amount. She didn't know what Shamia Fagan, in fact, the rest of us don't know what Shamia Fagan, resigned Secretary of State, had promised to do for LaMotta. But from the outside, it appears that what she was doing was she was taking money in exchange for her influence over state agencies, because her agency, the Secretary of State's office, was doing an audit of LaMotta. And she influenced the audit. And then only at the last minute did she recuse herself from the audit and say, I can't be involved in this because I have a consulting contract with one of the companies that's affected by OLCC. The agency was being audited. Well, she told Governor Kotek about that to her face 1 week before Kotek acted surprised to find out about this. And she said she was dismayed. Well, let me tell you something, folks. When the governor comes out and says, I was dismayed by this report that Shamia Fagan had this consulting arrangement, and we now know as of today that Tina Kotek knew that Shamia Fagan was being paid to work as a paid consultant to LaMotta. Now, did she give the governor all the details? No. But if the governor was dismayed by these reports, Tina Kotek needs to explain to Oregon, to all of the voters in Oregon, why didn't she, when Shamia Fagan said, by the way, I'm going to have to recuse myself from an audit of the OLCC that is almost finished, meaning all the influence she'd already had on it had she'd done while she was on the payroll of LaMotta. When Governor Kotek heard that news, she needs to explain these things, at least as far as I see it. She needs to explain when then-Secretary of State Shamia Fagan said, I'm under contract with LaMotta, which is regulated by the OLCC, which is being audited by my office. Did Tina Kotek object to that seemingly corrupt arrangement? If she did not, why did she not object to it? That's a very simple question. And why did you tell the press that you were dismayed later when it became public? And I would advance this theory. Tina Kotek got elected in part with money from the Democrat Party, $500,000 of which came from the FTX cryptocurrency scam that blew up, cost people hundreds of millions of dollars. But her party took $500,000 from that. Did her party return the money so it could go back to the people who were ripped off? She did not. Are they seeking criminal prosecution of people in the Democrat Party for taking the money under a false name? The Democrat Party received the donation under a false name. That is a felony crime. Why is Tina Kotek allowing that to happen? Why isn't she saying, I demand that if people broke the law and committed a felony by taking all that money? And why is she now saying she's only dismayed by what Fagan did? because Tina Kotek benefited as well from LaModa and from FTX, and so did Congresswoman Val Hoyle. She's got too much to protect. I think at this point, Tina Kotek needs to submit her resignation or explain to the public what's going on.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the craziest things you could do if you're running a state is say, I know, I've got a crazy idea. Let's legalize hard drugs, and then we'll step back like you're a scientist in a lab running mice or rats through a maze and say, let's see what happens when we legalize hard drugs. Well, in this case, it's not just one state, it's two states. State of Oregon de facto legalized hard drugs, and what we're getting is more dead people, more criminal activity, more of everything bad and nothing good out of it. And then in Washington state, it wasn't even the people who did it like it was in Oregon with Measure 110. It was the Washington State Supreme Court that said, I know, we're going to wipe out the state's hard drug law, and then we'll double dog dare the legislature to actually do something about it, because the Washington Supreme Court is liberal, and so are a bunch of people who control a lot of the legislature. And they said, we know those Democrat lawmakers, they don't want to criminalize hard drugs. They think it works out better without laws against hard drugs. Well, one of the people who represents people in the state of Washington is Senator Keith Wagner. He's from District 39, and he's not one of those guys who thinks that legalizing hard drugs was a terrific idea. Senator Wagner, welcome back.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be back, and I'm glad you clarified that at the end. I was starting to worry.
I wasn't going to lump you in with the D party, the drug party, the death party, whatever you want to call them, but they really did a dirty trick, and there are dead bodies in all of Washington state as a result of what was done. So Jay Inslee says you didn't get a new hard drug law during the regular session, so he'll call a short special session, and the promise is we'll get something meaningful out of it. Are we going to?
Well, I think so. And you have had me on at a very interesting time, because I just walked away from watching the floor who is debating our compromise bill right now. So that bill passed off the Senate floor this morning with great bipartisan support, only 6 no votes, 3 R's and 3 D's voted against the bill, and it's being debated right now on the House floor. And I think it's a bill that is not a fix, but it's an improvement, and it's going to save lives. And I hope like heck that the House passes this bill.
Well, Senator Wagner, I'd be remiss if I didn't say thank you for walking away from that. I wanted to get you back in time in case there's a vote you're involved in making this thing happen. But that's where I was going to go next. This so-called compromise bill would make possession of small amounts of illegal drugs a gross misdemeanor. Is that enough?
Well, it's not enough, but it's all we were going to get in this political environment. And to be clear, I stood with Senator Patton's proposed bill, which would have returned drug possession to a felony. But that bill was not brought forward. So what we had to work with was at least getting from a simple misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor, and also building in the ability for people to be compelled to get help, because that is so important. And what I think is another important thing to note about this whole process and the fact that we're back here, it shows that even when the Republicans are in the minority, we have had the ability to affect this bill. Because if we hadn't stood our ground and pushed back, you'd be looking at a bill much closer to total decriminalization of drug use.
Why? Now, if the legislature had not acted now, and not acted till July, or not acted after July 1, the state of Washington would have gone to all hard drugs are legal all the time?
Essentially so. It would have allowed municipalities, counties, and cities to make some of their own rules to protect themselves, but I don't have faith that that would happen everywhere in the state, given some of the local leadership. So I think a statewide solution that's at least workable is a much better solution than having this patchwork of regulation across the state, so people wouldn't even know if they were in the right or in the wrong or what the consequences would be. So to me, it's very important that we get a workable solution that's going to save lives. And I think this compromise bill, I don't call it a Blake fix. I call it a Blake improvement. And I suspect that we will have to go back and make improvements to it over time in following sessions. But it's going to give local government, prosecutors, law enforcement, and people who provide health care to people who are addicted and trying to beat it, it's going to give all of them tools to make the state safer.
Senator, I'll use a metaphor because my audience hates me for some of my metaphors, but I want to know if it's going to get to the place it needs to be, because when it was a felony, a judge almost always would say to somebody caught with drugs, they'd say, you can go into treatment or you can take the felony. And 90, 95% of the people said, judge, I'll go into treatment. And if I stay in it for a year, you'll wipe the felony off my record. That worked very well, but it had to be a big enough incentive. I'd compare it to this. I think I haven't had a parking ticket in downtown Seattle in a long time, but I think they're about $50 or $60. That's enough to incentivize you to avoid getting a parking ticket. If a parking ticket was a buck, I might just say, well, screw it. I'll take the parking ticket. Big deal. Every year I'll pay 10 or 12 of them or 15 of them, and it's of no consequence to pay $10 or $12 versus, you know, thousands of dollars. Is a gross misdemeanor enough to get most or even a substantial number of people caught with drugs into treatment?
So that's a really big concern. And the way the bill is written, you can get sentenced up to 180 days for the first two offenses. I think that's kind of on the borderline. Is that going to compel people into treatment, or are they going to take the time? I don't know. But the third offense gives you 364 days that the judge may apply.
Well,
and I think that could be effective. So, it, as I said, it's not an ideal solution. Somebody's going to have to make a choice whether they want to get help or do the shorter amount of time. I wish we could have gotten to some mandatory minimums, but that was gutted in the last attempt during the regular session.
Okay, but Senator, the old problem with the current law that's in place till July 1 was somebody had to count those occurrences, and you said most of the jurisdictions didn't do that because you had to count one, two, or three and get to the higher penalties. Is that now going to be part of the process, that all these cities and counties are going to have to count all the number ones and number twos so when you get to number three, they can throw the book at somebody or offer them treatment?
No, this is a better system. So you're right. The current system, there's nobody keeping track of strikes. So we say three strikes, but it really means infinite strikes. But under the compromise bill, these will be court filings, and they will be kept track of, much like DUIs are kept track of today. So in that respect, the bill is much better. I just wish that the sentencing penalties would be higher to do exactly what you suggested. You have to compel people because they're weighing what's going to be more painful to me, doing time or going and getting treatment.
Absolutely right. That's Senator Keith Wagner from District 39. Senator Wagner, thank you very much. Back in a moment, is Joe Biden going to force Americans to bear the cost of his illegal alien invasion? We'll talk about that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Joe Biden is going to force individual Americans, and in many cases, Americans who really are not the best situated people, to bear this burden. He's going to force the burden of illegal aliens on average Americans. And I'm going to give you a specific example that's going on right now. But first, I want to invite you to join the conversation. If you'd like to take part in what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, you might say, Lars, you have spent a huge amount of time over the last 25 years talking about the problem of illegal aliens. I've highlighted the problem of crime because too many illegal aliens disproportionately are involved in criminal activity. Donald Trump was exactly right in 2015 when he said, when they send people across that border illegally, they do not send their best. In fact, there are numbers that show that illegal aliens, while they are a small part of the overall U.S. population, they commit a disproportionate number of murders, of rapes, of assaults, of theft, of driving under the influence. And the numbers are right there. Now, most of the mainstream media doesn't want to take a look at that. And most of the government has said, we don't even want to collect the numbers, and we certainly don't want to leave them out. Which is why these days, especially in sanctuary states, most of those sanctuary states and blue cities and blue states, they don't even want to identify people who are sitting in jail about whether or not they're on an immigration hold or not, because they know that many of us for a decade or two would say, well, if you've got a jail population that's representative of the state or the county that you're in, it should have about this percentage of people there who are illegal aliens accused of murder, rape, robbery, assault, and things like that. Turns out the illegal aliens make up a larger percentage than they do in the population. So having said that, here's what's going to happen. The burden of the 9 million plus illegal aliens who have crossed into America in just the last 2.5 years is starting to fall on Americans. And let me give you two examples, one from New York City and one from California. And I'm willing to bet that these same kinds of things are playing out everywhere in this country. They just tend to be accentuated in high population states like New York and like California. So, for example, 6 public elementary schools in New York City are going to take their gymnasiums, kids are still in school at this point in the year, and they are going to use them to temporarily house illegal aliens who have flooded into the city. You say, hold on a second. That means the schools, at elementary schools in particular, where kids, even if the weather is lousy, whether it's too hot or too cold in New York, this time of year it tends to be kind of hot, then you say, well, the kids are going to go down and they're going to have gym class. And you say, nope. There are 6 schools in Brooklyn that are going to be used to house adult illegal aliens. And they say 5 more schools are already being prepared for that same kind of load. The 2 schools put cots in the gymnasium yesterday in preparation to host busloads of illegal aliens as soon as today. Now, parents said the school will be locked down with no recess and no physical education because the gym is adjacent to the outdoor playground. Now, this ought to be an outrage for parents, for taxpayers, whether you've got kids in school or not. If you say we provide those public schools so that kids can go to school of an appropriate age. And in fact, take note of this. Damaris Fernandez, who is a parent of students at MS 577 and PS Public School 17, said, when you're a parent and you go to the school on legitimate business involving your child, you have to sign in and provide picture ID when you go into the school. And she said, now there are migrants in the playground. Now, do you know what that means? It's a problem I've complained about for a long time. Illegal aliens often have, in America, superior rights to the rights enjoyed by citizens. And if you say, well, Lars, how could that be? Well, here's a good example, that if you are at a school and you're an adult and you show up on legitimate business to see your child, to visit a teacher, whatever it is that you're planning to do, you have to present picture ID and you have to sign in. Now you got a bunch of illegal aliens and largely unscreened illegal aliens. When the Border Patrol writes them a ticket, they use whatever name the illegal alien gives them. Most of the people who are coming in, depending on where they're coming from, have thrown away their actual picture ID. In fact, I've talked to some of the people who go down to the border, and they're part of groups that don't like this stuff. And they look around and they find piles of picture ID. In fact, yesterday I mentioned I've got a piece of Cuban currency. And I asked the man who found it, I said, did you find a lot of this? He says it's all over the place. Because many times, if people are coming in from a country that's not favored, like Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, they don't want to be identified as Cuban. And so they want a Cuban currency on them. Also, they can't really spend the Cuban currency in the United States, so they just throw it away in the desert. They throw away driver's licenses. They throw away their matricula consular, which is their consular card. And why do they do that? Because they don't want to be identified. Now, if you wonder why somebody wouldn't want to be identified, because if you can identify somebody with picture ID, you can call the seek the information from foreign countries. Is this person a good person? Are they a convicted criminal? Are they an accused criminal? Do they have a rap sheet? And if they throw away the ID, they take on a new identity. So they show up in New York City by the busload. Local authorities have no way of knowing who these people are or what they're about or whether or not they have criminal records. So when you have parents who are being told, when you come to see your child, you have to identify yourself, show picture ID, and sign in. But if you're an illegal alien, we're going to allow you to live inside the school where elementary age kids up to about age 11 or 12 are going to school because you, as an illegal alien, have superior rights. Another example of that is Joe Biden has been providing taxpayer-funded chartered airplane flights and oftentimes putting illegals on commercial airplane flights. Well, as you know, you show up at the airport, they say, where's your picture ID? You don't have picture ID, you're not getting on the plane. But the illegal alien shows up and says, well, I told the Border Patrol my name was Jose Ramirez, even though it might not have been. Here's the ticket they wrote me. That gets them on the plane. You have what amounts to illegal aliens who are super citizens in the United States. They have more rights than actual American citizens. And if anybody thinks that's a healthy situation, I'd be glad to take your call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If I were honest with you, and I try to be honest with you every single day, I don't think unions have any business representing any government workers, and especially when it comes to schools. And the reason is, it is an incestuous relationship where the labor union represents hundreds of thousands, in some cases tens of thousands, but large numbers of public employees. And then they gather up gigantic amounts of money. Just do the math. Say 500,000 public workers times $1,000 a year is $500 million. And it takes very little of that, a smaller proportion of it, to run the union. And the rest of it, they spend on politics. And as I know, the number is about 99% on Democrats, who then vote for more money for the union. It is insider trading at its worst. But then you've got Randy Weingarten, who is the head of the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, the largest teachers union in America, I believe, although Max will correct me if I'm wrong. Max Nelson is director of labor policy at the Freedom Foundation. Hey, Max, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Pleasure to be back.
So you've got Randy Weingarten heading up the AFT to represent all the teachers in America. Was she really a teacher?
So Randy Weingarten has extremely limited teaching experience. And just to for a minor correction here at the outset.
Oh, I'm sorry.
AFT, oh, no worries. It's relevant to the point. AFT, American Federation of Teachers, is one of the two large teachers unions in the country, the other being the National Education Association, which is actually by far the larger of the two. Now, Weingarten has positioned herself, though, as the face of teachers and teachers unions in America, primarily due to her long tenure as a union officer, as head of the AFT. The NEA, the National Education Association, has term limits for its officers. And so the current president, Becky Pringle, has been in that role for about 2 years, I believe. She'll be replaced by somebody else, you know, a few years from now. And they cycle through. Pringle is actually a career teacher. Weingarten at AFT faces no term limits under the AFT bylaws and constitution, and she's been in a union leadership role for over a quarter century. The last time she set foot in the classroom was back in 1997. And so she taught part-time in New York City public schools, 2 hours a day as a per diem substitute from 1991 to 94, and then served as a regularly appointed teacher from 94 to 97. My guess is she actually started out as a union employee, as a union attorney for the New York City affiliate of the AFT in the late 80s, and became very close with the president of that local affiliate at the time. And my sense is, reading between the lines here, is that the outgoing president of that local union wanted Weingarten to succeed her. But to do that, Weingarten had to roll up her sleeves a little bit and spend at least a little time in the classroom.
A couple of hours a day as a per diem teacher. Is that what it was? A couple of hours a day?
Correct. For the first 3 years there, while she's still on staff at the union at the time. So anyway, she put in a little bit of time in New York City public schools, took over the New York City affiliate in 97, and then took over the national AFT in 2008.
And so
she's an attorney by trade and a union officer more than anything else.
I'm talking to Max Nelson, who's director of labor policy at the Freedom Foundation. Why you'd say, well, union's a private organization. Why does this bother anybody else? She is now credited with 11 and a half years of service, so-called, to the teachers' retirement system of New York City. She gets 11 and a half years of credit, having taught a couple of hours a day for 3 years, and she could get pension benefits on the basis of that?
That's exactly right, Lars. So the Freedom Foundation just put out a report today documenting this, and this is crazy stuff. You can't make it up. So as I mentioned a moment ago, she worked part-time in public schools for 3 years, full-time, I think, from what I can tell, for another 3 years. And as a public school teacher, she was paying, at least while she was working full-time, she was paying into the city-run, taxpayer-funded pension plan for New York City public school teachers. Now, from what I can calculate here, she would have accrued, based on her actual time worked as a teacher in New York City, she would have accrued a little over 4 years of service credit in the pension plan. Now, to become eligible for any benefits, to become vested in the plan, teachers have to work for 5 years, or they have to accrue 5 years of service credit. So she would have fallen short of vesting in the pension plan based solely on her classroom teaching experience. However, there's a provision in the union contract with the city that allows teachers to be placed on union leave if they're elected to serve as union officers.
Yep.
And that's exactly what happened when Weingarten was elected the head of UFT in 1997. And she's been on union leave. We verified this as part of our research. To this day, she's listed in the New York City public school system as an employee on union leave. And so documents that we obtained then from the retirement plan showed that she's been credited with 15 and a half years of service credit in the pension system, despite actually only working for 4 of those years. And so essentially what happened was the city retirement plan was counting her time as a full-time union officer, not working in the classroom, but head of the United Federation of Teachers in New York, was counting her time as the head of that union as though she was accruing service credit, just like a teacher working every day in and out in the classroom. And absent that counting toward her service credit, she wouldn't have been eligible for pension benefits at all.
So in other words,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so she, as the top negotiator or the person who's head of the union, gets to benefit from the contract that she leads in negotiating.
Yes, correct. So whenever she decides to retire, she could retire now and be eligible for full pension benefits. She's 65. Let's say she retires 5 years from now at age 70, draws pension benefits for 15 years, you know, average life expectancy for a female in New York is about 85. So just very conservatively, if she draws pension benefits for 15 years after retiring at age 70, that would cost taxpayers well over $200,000, not taking into account cost of living adjustments that the pension plan provides, not taking into account a couple other factors. But for the pension plan counting her time out of the classroom as a union president, she wouldn't have been eligible for anything at all. But because of the sweetheart deal in the union contract, she could ultimately cost taxpayers several hundred thousand dollars in pension.
And let me ask you this, Max. Is the New York teacher's pension well-funded? Because I'm used to finding that almost every public pension in America is upside down, in some cases, literally hundreds of billions of dollars.
Well, I don't know that very many pension systems could be described, public pension systems could be described as well-funded. I couldn't give you off the top of my head a rundown on the status in New York. But it's certainly concerning from a taxpayer standpoint. Just to illustrate a little bit how crazy this is, when a New York City teacher is working full-time, they have to pay a certain percentage of their salary into the pension plan. No, it's right. A lot less than what the city has to pick up, what taxpayers have to pick up. But just based on the numbers that we have and her teaching record as we've been able to document it, Weingarten would have paid about $7,000 in wages based on the 6 years that she was employed part-time and then full-time.
Wow. 7,000 in, 200,000 out. That's Max Nelson, the Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation. Max, I appreciate you coming on. Back in a moment, we'll get to your calls. We'll talk about Joe Biden and what he says is the biggest threat in America, and you might be surprised by it. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. It's a Tuesday. It's a beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest, as long as we can get some kind of explanation from Governor Tina Kotek, the brand new, only months in office. And by the way, we've seen other governors who've had to resign or retire in disgrace months in. I think Tina Kotek may be facing exactly that same result. But let me explain that in just a moment. There's a brand new development involving Governor Kotek, the corruption of the donations in cash made by one of the largest weed retailers in the Pacific Northwest, LaModa, the resignation of Secretary of State Shamia Fagan, and now Kotek's refusal at so far to explain what it was she was actually doing and why she didn't demand an answer from Shamia Fagan when Kotek first learned of the corruption that was going on in the Secretary of State's office. First, though, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our Twitter poll that actually relates to Governor Kotek, although I wrote it before we learned the most recent information, which only came in the last couple of hours. Now that we know that Governor Kotek lied to the public about what she knew of the corruption of former Secretary of State Fagan, should Kotek resign as well? My answer to that is yes. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I asked you this. Is spending more and more money on the homeless only making the problem worse? Seattle and King County have been spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars every year for the better part of the last decade, and now they're spending more. Portland and Multnomah County have been spending about $100 million a year on the so-called homeless problem, and the problem has only become worse. In fact, yesterday I pointed out to you that even as Multnomah County was jacking up a brand new tax of $200 million, that they were going to bring in to spend exclusively on the so-called homeless, about 5,000 or 6,000 people, meaning that the homeless have superior government service to what average taxpayers get. Is it just making the problem worse? Well, last year, while they were raising this new money, Multnomah County saw an increase in the number of homeless by about 21%. That suggests to me the more money that government spends, the way it's spending on this problem, the worse the problem gets. So I ask you the question, does it make it worse? I said yes. That's 86% of the vote. Does it make it better? Only 2% of you said it makes it better, and 12% of you said it makes no difference whatsoever. So find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Now, let me tell you about the latest information we know. The headline late this afternoon, Governor Tina Kotek orders the state of Oregon to withhold cannabis licenses from Oregon businesses that have not paid their taxes. Wow. Talk about the horse out of the barn. Because here's what you should know. While Oregon and Washington both have legalized recreational pot, Washington State says you can have at most 5 retail licenses. Lamoda has about 4 times that number. And how did they get that number when they owed hundreds of thousands of dollars in the weed fees that they're supposed to pay to the OLCC? How did they get that and run up a total debt to the Oregon Department of Revenue in taxes, to the IRS in taxes, of about $7 million? Well, it's because the state didn't care. State said, you're behind on your taxes to the feds and the state. You're behind on your weed fees. Governor Tina Kotek announced today that businesses that have not paid their taxes will not be able to obtain or renew licenses to sell marijuana in Oregon, an order aimed at improving tax compliance. This will help ensure that all businesses are operating under the same rules and not getting any competitive advantage if they haven't paid their taxes. Let me grab a call because I'm going to tell you more about this tomorrow, but let me go to Ken. Hey, Ken, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I live, and my wife, we live quite a bit of the time in Mexico, in Mazatlan. There is a large condominium building down there. Half of that building has been financed through the East Coast Teachers Union in the United States.
Wonderful.
I know this through a friend of mine.
And what's this? I know what I would read into that. What do you see the significance in that?
Well, they have to have money to pay the future teachers. So they're counting on this to be revenue to come in for the future. That's what I
think. Good luck with that, because I don't think they need to do it, Ken. The union isn't worried about it. In fact, Joe Biden just did, just as a short note, because we're close to the break, he just did a $35 billion bailout on one of the largest unions, not a teachers union, in America. So in other words, when the unions run short, they just turn to the taxpayers, and the taxpayers stupidly and foolishly bail them out, and we shouldn't do it. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.